Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by news editor Emma Powell. How are you doing, Emma?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Excellent. And commodities correspondent Alex Newman, how are you? And podcast editor.
Yes.
Lest I forget.
I'm well.
You're my boss in this this relationship here.
Oh no, it's got very confusing.
Anyway, so we're going to talk, Alex, because there's been a lot of news from the commodity space this week. Not all of it good.
Yeah, not
in fact,
a lot
most,
of it.
In fact, pretty much all of it bad, which we thought was behind us, but never mind. Lots going on elsewhere in the markets. We had a busy week on the results front too. We'll touch on some of those. Megan seems to have written half a magazine again. Megan's not here today, unfortunately, but you can pick that up.
I can.
You can. So let's start with 7 days.
Seven days.
What's going on, Emma?
Well, we've got, talking to Megan's beat, obviously she does telecoms. We've got BT heading into negotiations with its pension trustees. Basically, they're trying to save some cash. I think BT's pension scheme, defined benefit pension scheme, is classed as the second worst funded in the world. It's got a massive deficit, multi-billion pound deficit. But BT, obviously, don't just want to keep on plugging the deficit or trying to plug the deficit, which keeps rising, with cash. Because obviously that means that, you know, there'll be less to invest in the business.
Or less to pay dividends.
Less to pay down its debt as it matures, or refinance its debt as it matures. What they've kind of hinted at in their annual report is that they will give the pension scheme prior ownership over certain assets, which is actually a growing trend by companies and their pension schemes, because ultimately a lot of pension scheme trustees do just want the cash, really. But from a company perspective, you want to invest that cash in the business.
Yeah, you need the business to keep performing.
Exactly.
I mean, plugging the deficit sounds great, but if you don't invest in the business, then the whole thing is going to spiral out of control and get worse.
Yeah, probably. So it is a growing trend. When I used to report on pensions, you'd hear of things like contingent assets like cheese or whiskey.
Cheese?
Cheese is one. Cheese.
We're talking Dairy Crest here, are we?
I think we are, yeah, it must be. Diageo with the whiskey, that's another one.
Yeah, so they're long maturing assets, aren't they? So,
yeah,
okay,
exactly.
That's quite interesting.
So
what's
like,
what sort of assets is BT talking about?
They didn't give any colour, really. They just said prior ownership of assets, so I mean, who knows? Some of the infrastructure, I mean, who knows?
It's funny, I got a strange email from a reader this week about pensions, and it seems that that whoever is in charge of kind of overseeing companies' relationships with their pension schemes is going to be applying more pressure for companies to make sure that their schemes are fully funded. And that sounds to me like bad news potentially for shareholders, particularly those shareholders in companies where dividends are being currently prioritised.
Yeah, I mean, it is tricky. And like going back the past few years now, companies are trying to be more and more inventive about how they try and plug deficits without just piling cash into it. Because of the way kind of gilts are at the moment, the deficits keep rising. And I guess it's very frustrating. You know, in the case of BT, this is obviously what's happened. And you don't just want to keep plowing more and more cash in and the deficit keeping on rising anyway. They put 1.5 billion in, that was in 2015, and then 250 million in 2016 and 17. And obviously they set recovery plans every 3 years when a scheme has its valuation. So now they're just going into the negotiations now that's taking place from this week onwards.
It's interesting, actually. I mean, I've looked at this before, this whole deficit issue. Deficits tend to be larger, it seems, in companies that have previously been state-owned and then spun into a privatised, essentially. So these are the legacy pension issues going back many, many years, probably as far back as the time when it was state-owned. You know, I remember one, Unic, which was a dairy company, had a huge deficit issue.
I think Royal Mail had a
Royal Mail
issue, yeah.
has problems like that. Yeah, it does seem to be some, you know, getting all political now, because that's where we are. But yeah, public companies tend to have this problem more than others. Former public companies.
Was that the reader's concern then?
The reader didn't seem to have any concern. He seemed to think this was great news. That this was, but I kind of read it completely the opposite to the observation that our dear reader had made. I think pension deficits are a problem, and particularly for those companies where dividends are being prioritised currently. But hey, let's move on. Enough about the technicalities of pension accounting and cheese, whiskey. What else have we got, Emma?
There's been more developments on the RBS front. So after really going for it, the RBS Shareholders Action Group, which represents thousands of retail institutional investors, has decided they've issued a letter saying they've decided to accept the revised compensation offer, which went from 41p to 82p a share. It's below, I think they were holding out for a range between 92 right up to 234 pence a share. So what that means is basically Fred Goodwin may avoid the trial, which I think, I mean, the whole thing would have been really embarrassing for him and I think the company. So they're very keen to avoid that.
So this is over then, is it?
Well, it's not completely over because it's yet to be formally agreed, and also there could be, I mean, potentially, if you wanted to, any claimant who wanted to continue pursuing the lawsuit would have to find funding to do that, bearing in mind then if you lose, you'd be liable to pay RBS's costs, which I think at the moment are about 25 million.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to be liable for that. I had an email on this issue too from a guy who perhaps had not spotted much earlier that they perhaps needed to look into how they got involved in this, a former shareholder who had taken up the right that this issue centres upon, and he was asking whether he can get involved now. And I suspect the answer is no.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I do know, particularly for the Shareholder Action Group, if you go on the website, it says applications are closed. So
they closed a long time ago.
Yeah, presumably. Yeah. So it's definitely closed now. So no, I think that ship might have sailed.
That ship has sailed if you haven't got involved. And it would have been months and months and months ago that you'd have had to put your claim in.
Yeah, this has been so long running.
It's worth pointing out, though, that there are definitely some shareholders who weren't really, compensation was never the priority for them. They just wanted to see Fred Goodwin's
day
in court. So that may end up, you know, pushing RBS into the witness stand at some point.
Yeah, I did read that. I mean, you have got institutional investors in there, and I mean, who knows? Maybe, you know, it'll cost them a lot of money, but I did read that maybe they just want that satisfaction of seeing him on the stand. Maybe.
I mean, it was the worst takeover of all time. I mean, it really has to, you can't, I mean, if there's a top 10, it's in there. I mean, it might not be the worst. I'm sure there may be one or two you could point to, but I mean, this was done, the takeover of ABN AMRO, as far as I'm aware, without any really intensive due diligence. I mean, it was negligent.
Yeah, it was just the drive to be bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, as I've often said in my editorials, big is not always best. Which is why I never fully understand why AIM gets disparaged so much, because small, nimble companies often do great things. Okay, what else have we got, Emma?
We've got the car finance market, yeah. US car finance market.
Yeah, so over here, the FCA is looking at this market because they're concerned, but in America, the concerns have kind of raced ahead, as it were.
Yeah, so we've been hearing about this for a while, kind of hearing rumours about this, but now we've had the first the first sequential drop in lending by the kind of commercial banks, big commercial banks in the US to the motor market. So there have been concerns about underwriting standards anyway in the US. And now, obviously, in the UK, the motor market, I mean, it's particularly PCP over here.
That is the most unfortunately named financial product I've ever heard. That's PCP is the acronym for the drug colloquially known as angel dust, is it not?
I don't know.
And other addictive substances.
Yeah, so it's kind of the latest part of the market in terms of the UK, that the FCA, you know, they've already gone after credit cards. So we are actually going to be writing a kind of broader piece on the car finance market.
Good.
Because there's a lot of kind of players in that sector.
I'm very nervous about this market.
I agree.
For a number of reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, and so the FCA investigation review is going to centre on how loose or tight have the underwriting standards been.
Loose, I suspect, is the answer.
Probably,
they're going to find.
Because the market's exploded since the financial crisis. It absolutely exploded in the US as well. When the mortgage market kind of people turned away from that, this was seen as, you know, another big growth area.
And so what worries me is that, I mean, I'm not so worried that there is going to be a huge wave of defaults that, you know, will cripple the banking system in the same way that we saw 9 years ago in the financial crisis. But what I am concerned about is that the FCA says, yeah, standards aren't what they should be. We need to tighten these up. And it just puts the brakes on the car market, which is a big driver of the UK economy.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's so many companies are exposed to this, from the retailers, the manufacturers, people that provide finance. So it's, in terms of listed companies, there's a lot.
Yeah.
So, John, why is your inkling that this is, you know, this has been a poorly overseen sector, or that there is risk?
It's going back to the old sort of gut feel and scuttlebutt, but you see a lot of people driving around in very flash cars, and I just, you know what the average wage is in the UK. You know that, you know, therefore most people you see around are kind of somewhere around the sort of the mean, and they're driving around in very, very expensive cars. And I look at this and think, this doesn't make any sense. Mm. I'm driving around an old banger that I got off my brother, who bought a car with a PCP.
Not angel dust. Yeah.
Not angel dust. I think we need to keep an eye on this one. We've said this before. I'm interested on this page, before we move on, with this IPO story. We're paying a bit more attention to IPOs under your watch, Emma. We didn't entirely agree about the mattress IPO.
Yeah.
Tell me about this one.
Yeah, so Alpha Financial Software is the company. They've just started trading this week, and they're the biggest IPO of the year so far, biggest tech IPO in the UK in 2 years. So it was very oversubscribed. The shares are up now more than a quarter on the original listing price.
What does it do?
So it provides software to banks and also other companies that provide asset finance.
Right, okay. Big market? One assumes it is, if this is such a popular IPO.
Yes, I think it is a big market. Think about the amount of compliance software that a bank needs.
Yes, indeed.
So it's
indeed.
All that kind of thing.
But there are lots of companies in that market already, but there you go. Talking of banks, there's a bank IPO coming as well.
Oh, yes. Allied Irish is coming. 25% of the shares are going to be listed in Ireland and London. They've kind of estimated that it'll be between 12 billion and 13 billion market cap. Obviously, people might remember Allied Irish, a very, very troubled bank.
This year, and we spoke about it this week, this year marks the 10th anniversary of the collapse of Northern Rock. Which kind of got the ball rolling on the whole financial crisis.
Yeah, and
obviously the Irish banks were banging the centre of that.
Yeah.
Is this something that we should be looking at, taking seriously? Has it changed dramatically?
Well, I mean, they do make the point that it's been reporting pre-tax profits for the past 3 years. It's kind of really reduced its non-performing loans. I mean, ultimately, we'll really know and be able to analyse it properly when we get the prospectus through.
Presumably, its non-performing loans previously were property-related, largely.
I can imagine so, yes. I mean, it was Allied Irish and obviously Anglo-Irish that ultimately sought Ireland to get a bailout from the EU. So, yeah.
But there's actually quite a few Irish property companies listed in the UK now, particularly in the commercial property space, which seems to be doing really nicely. And also look really kind of well positioned to benefit if there's any transition of financial services employees out of the UK when we approach Brexit.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Ireland, maybe worth looking at. We've got lots of Irish readers, actually. We do. And there's lots of Irish companies on the stock market. Should we talk about commodities?
Sure.
Let's talk Petrofac. Let's get this dirty story out of the way.
Right.
Where do you start? It is a mess.
I suppose you start on the 12th of May, and that was when, out of the blue, Petrofac updated the market on the Serious Fraud Office's investigation into Unioil, which is a Monaco-based fixer of sorts.
When you hear the word fixer, you immediately think, "Ooh, that sounds dodgy."
Right. I mean, it's sort of tabloid reduction for introducing and helping oil and gas companies in their contracts bidding around the world.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Rolls Royce had similar problems with fixers.
Mm.
Intermediaries, I believe.
Intermediaries, yes, to get the terminology absolutely correct, not to reduce it in tabloid style. Similar problem?
Well,
it does seem to be.
I mean, with Unioil, I mean, the investigation, I mean, in terms of identifying the specific problem, this was a big expose by an Australian media group last year. In terms of what the problem is and, you know, the various allegations, I think maybe it's not necessarily something we'd go into now.
We can't. We have to be careful.
Yeah.
We can only report upon. We have to be very careful.
Of course. But what we do know is the Unioil investigation that the SFO is currently carrying out, insofar as it impinges or touches upon Petrofac, centres on their dealings in Kazakhstan between 2002 and 2009, when Unaoil was hired by Petrofac. So we had this announcement on the 12th of May that Petrofac is now also under investigation by the SFO. Also that the COO, Marwan Chedid, and the CEO, Ayman Asfari, had been interviewed under caution as part of that investigation. So there's there's quite a violent share price reaction on the day. Bear Bull, as our readers, some of our readers will know, wrote a very good piece on that, saying that, at that point, saying there was not enough sufficient information to make a call either way, and he wasn't selling out. 6 days later, a non-exec called Jane Sadowski, who'd only joined in November, resigned. There's no explanation from the company for that.
Yeah, but you can see... Never
good to see. And then a week later, we got the true bombshell. It's pretty much as bad as it gets for an RNS. Petrofac had suspended Marwan Chedid. They revealed that both he and... Ayman Asfari had been interviewed whilst under arrest by the SFO, which is not previously disclosed. And being interviewed under caution doesn't necessarily mean you've been arrested.
Yeah.
Not only that, but they said that Petrofac had not cooperated with the investigation or not been deemed to cooperate, which for sentencing, if it does come to that, is very, very serious.
Because Rolls-Royce, going back to my initial question, did cooperate fully with the authorities throughout the investigation. Yeah. So a bit different already here.
And the board of Petrofac now, obviously, sees how serious this is and how serious they need to take the investigation and be seen to be taking the investigation. As a result, they've basically parked the CEO away from the SFO investigation, away from clients, and off the nomination committee, so he is now no longer has any responsibilities for removing or appointing directors. They've brought in an independent consultant to work with the board and the SFO, and the other revelation as well was that the internal investigation, which was carried out by Freshfields, the law firm, last year, commissioned by Petrofac, was not accepted by the SFO or what came of that report. So it's pretty much as bad as it gets. And I agree with Bear Bull in this week's column. We've written to a similar effect in the tips page that this is now an existential matter for Petrofac.
Right. So Bear Bull previously had them in his income portfolio. He's sold them. Yeah. You had them on a buy.
Yeah.
And you've switched to a sell.
Yeah.
So, why is this now existential? Why have we switched from a buy to a sell? Why is it that this has raised the prospect of this company essentially ceasing to exist potentially?
I mean, the first thing you'd say is that there's quite possibly going to be a big fine coming. This scandal's not going to go along.
But fines companies can handle.
Sure. Companies can handle it, and Petrofac has got supportive banking relationships, which they reiterated this week. Say they get lopped with a $1 billion fine, that's not going to destroy the company necessarily. What is really problematic is the reputational risk as so long as this continues, and even after a resolution is arrived at. The company is built around the CEO. I mean, Ayman Asfari has been with the company for nearly three decades. He will be the point man, along with his CEO, who's now no longer with the company, for winning contracts. You'd struggle to see how Petrofac is now going to be winning and bidding for contracts with all oil and gas companies around the world, in the current, whilst under investigation. That's going to be very, very hard. And then finally, sorry, just to cap it off, to add to that, the company's already, will have learned, as investors will have learned, that there's legal action being proposed by various shareholders and their litigation funders coming in to back this legal action. That's particularly serious because it means that lawyers have sat down and they've seen the assurances Petrofac previously given and the revelations which have now come out and said there's a lawsuit here which could be filed and a chance of winning, and
that could be substantially larger than the fine.
Indeed, yeah. So it's just.
That, I'm sorry, I was going to say, please. Is that similar to the kind of RBS thing? Is it that you falsely?
Yeah,
or the Tesco thing we talked about recently as well.
Absolutely. So it would the the lawsuit presumably would be based, or the proposed lawsuit would be based on the idea that Petrofac misled investors previously when they said, we don't think that the unit oil matters has legs, really, because it seriously now looks like it does.
Yeah, I mean, you know, more broadly, we'll come back to Petrofac very shortly. You know, we talked about this recently about the rising prospect of companies being taken to court where there's felt to be some kind of behaviour that has lost shareholders money, and I'm slightly worried about that trend. But equally, if this is becoming a trend, then presumably companies are just going to have to behave a lot better.
Well, I mean, get compliance right first, and then, you know, and then that should reduce a company and its investors' worries about this.
It
looks quite starkly that compliance, you know, is at question here.
Indeed, it seems mad. I mean, you know, let's talk about trading, because, I mean, what we're talking about is the prospect that trading materially worsens because of their reputation impinging their ability to win new business. But how is trading looking right now? I mean, do they have a pipeline of new contracts? Have we seen evidence that's evaporating? Is there anything to say, actually, you know, even with this potential fine, shareholder lawsuit, trading is okay?
Yeah, there certainly is. And this is the bull case or the value case, which I struggle with it a little bit at the moment. But this is why people are still saying that, you know, the shares are a buy, specifically now that they've fallen over 50%.
People? Analysts?
Well, shareholders.
Not us.
Some shareholders. Not us. You know, I think I should take these you know, this point seriously.
I agree. Absolutely. But, it could be a value recovery opportunity.
Absolutely. And if it is, it's probably one of the best you'll see all year. I'd say there is an order book there that Petrofac has that runs into over $7 billion. These are long dated contracts, so, you know, cash is going to be coming in over the next few years. They've got long term relationships with oil and gas companies, state oil companies, which aren't going to disappear overnight just on the back of this current scandal. But that's assuming that the relationships can be maintained. If work is being commissioned at the moment and you have a few oil and gas service providers that you might push the work out to, would you necessarily go to Petrofac, given the scale of the challenge and the amount of time this is going to be consuming for management? I think that has to impact on trading.
Okay. So, I mean, you know, this is it's a really relatively smallish industry, oil services. You know, who's going to benefit from this if Petrofac does face an existential crisis and loses business?
Well, I mean, the obvious candidates would be the likes of John Wood and AMEC Foster Wheeler. But, I mean, last week, John Wood, in the circular they put out for the AMEC takeover, they've also raised various connections to unit oil and their own internal investigation.
I mean, that's an interesting point that I was about to raise. Is this just not the way business is done in this industry?
Right. Well, I mean, it's very opaque, isn't it? And it's hard to, I suppose, arrive at a definitive answer for, you know, to...
No, you're absolutely right. No, you're absolutely right, Alex. It is hard, but one assumes, you know, from what we've seen in various industries that are involved in selling to the far flung corners of the earth, where perhaps compliance standards are not as rigorous as they are elsewhere. This stuff is not uncommon. This kind of behaviour is not uncommon. There is an expectation that if you want to win a large contract with a state owned oil enterprise in, you know, God knows where, that some brown envelopes might change hands.
Absolutely, but this is why we have the Bribery Act, and this has been, you know, the SFO has lost some big high profile cases in the last years, but, you know, it's under David Green, it's you know, a lot more enforcement focused, and that, you know, they've had some significant recent victories as well. So I think judging the call on how much they like to get fined or trying to read in between the lines in the SFO's investigation is not something I think investors are able to do at the moment. For that reason, I think that's why we're quite so bearish.
Is it just the SFO, or is this going to go cross border in terms of the regulatory authorities that perhaps might get involved in this?
Let's see. I mean, the authorities, you know, regularly share information. I don't know if that's changing, you know, given light of recent fallouts between police services around the world. But yeah, I mean, who knows? These things have a tendency to spiral, don't they?
They do. But then, as we say, they also have, there will be something at the end of this that maybe we can reassess at the time that Absolutely. Might be a good opportunity for investors. But right now we're saying, just don't go near it.
Yeah.
Fair enough. While we're on the subject of oil services, Lamprell. I know you didn't write this one, Alex, but I'm sure you have a view. Has won a really interesting contract with Aramco, which is a company that you do know that we're currently looking at. This sounds amazing. Lamprell is a company that's had all sorts of troubles throughout the oil downturn, but does this mark the start of a bounce back?
Potentially. The details for the deal weren't entirely there, and it's always very hard, as we're talking about Petrofac as well, it's quite hard to know when you see these contracts announced what kind of margin that's going to turn into, what sort of cash flow and the profits which will result from it. But it's a huge deal for Lamprell. AMEC also announced another deal with Saudi Aramco. I think the other interesting question is, whether this growing, these deals announced is in a way a prelude to Aramco sort of, ahead of a potential listing in London.
Are we seeing this as, the kind of divining rods are out, these contracts with British oil services companies,
Potentially.
Here they come.
Though, of course, the oil services companies have worked with Saudi Aramco for a long time. It's the biggest producer of oil on earth. So, interesting deal. But I think it's always the case with oil services companies. It's very hard to judge whether it's a turning point on any one contract, really.
Okay, interesting. You've written a lot more in the news section this week. Derisory bid for Gemfields.
Yeah.
What do they make? We love the opening of this one. As a miner of coloured stones, Gemfields is used to being stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Apologies for that.
How we like it.
So Gemfields, they own Fabergé. They bought it off this company, Pallinghurst, which is a South African-listed diversified commodities group. Who have countered just a couple of years later with a nil premium bid for the 53% of shares they don't own in Gemfields. They've already got the support of about 20, I'm going to get the maths wrong here, but 27 or 28% of other shareholders, which will push them over to the point where they can force through a deal. Not great news for Gemfields minority shareholders, because the share price has done very, very badly in recent years. The board have suggested shareholders to take no action. I suppose that might be in the end all they can take, unless there is some sort of regulatory blockade to that. It is, as you said, stuck between a rock and a hard place, I think, at the moment.
It's a nice little business. I always like the look of it. But, I guess the reality has diverged with the narrative.
Yeah, somewhat. They're very, very well marketed. They've been hit by the Indian demonetization, which we talk about elsewhere in the magazine. Which many of their customers, or the gems that they sell their markets, they send their gems to, have been really hit by cash flow issues in the Indian economy in the last 6 months.
And they're semi precious stones, aren't they? They're not diamonds.
They're semi precious.
And what have the prices of those done? Is there a spot price for emerald?
It's again a very opaque market. Pricing has been. It's been a bit weak for coloured gems, as it has across the diamond market. But Gemfields always had this nice story that they were quite differentiated to the diamond miners, which perhaps a little bit more reliant on these mega stones that they dig out once or twice a year, and thus it's very, very hard to forecast anything. It's a real shame. It's hard to see really that this deal, doesn't. End up going through.
The rough and the smooth of the AIM markets.
Indeed.
There you go. Emma, let's talk about IP. I know you didn't write this, but you do know these companies. And I like this story. I think it's really interesting. We touched upon it last week. IP Group is raising some money, has put in a bid, a cheeky bid for one of its rivals.
Well, yeah, they approached Touchstone. IP's the biggest out of, there's Allied Mines, IP Group and Touchstone Innovations. And IP Group's the biggest. Touchstone, a lot smaller market cap, it approached IP IP's management approached Touchstone, suggesting a merger. Actually, we've had a bit more colour on that today when Touchstone Innovations Management issued a letter to shareholders. And it seems, I mean, all we were told at the time was that they couldn't agree terms. Well, now management of Touchstone have come out and said, actually, while he had a phone call with Mike Humphrey, the chairman of IP Group, and whilst they were initially told that it was a merger and the word merger had been used, actually it was a takeover. And I think their concerns were twofold. Firstly, they thought that the bid, which was or potential bid, which was an all share bid, undervalued Touchstone. And they give a few reasons in terms of the value of its unquoted assets,
which are almost unpriceable, but there you go.
Well, I mean, this is something else we discussed in the piece. It's practically impossible to value these companies. But another point he makes is that that it's a people-based business, and that, you know, you could suppose, since Touchstone would be the minority, since it would have comprised about 38%, I think, the shareholders of Touchstone would have had in this newly enlarged group, that there would have been losses. People losses at Touchstone.
It's a small industry. Where are they going
very
to go?
It's a very small industry. And funnily enough, on the day that this potential bid was announced, shares in Allied Mind were up 6%, presumably because people thought maybe they could be the next one. They've had a lot of troubles recently.
So what we're talking about in the piece, what Megan's talking about, is actually she thinks that actually there's a very strong case for getting all these companies together.
Yeah, because essentially why you would invest in these companies is, obviously, she covers a lot of, you know, biotech and early stage companies, which are very hard to value, quite high risk, very high risk, in fact, in terms of investment, because a lot of them aren't even making any money.
Well, indeed. And we have this week Redx Pharma, for example, a small biotech.
Exactly.
Which has basically gone bust.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
It has.
Yeah.
It's gone bust.
But I think the reason you really invest in these companies, like an IP group, is because you get exposure to a broad range of assets. So whilst, I mean, inevitably you're going to get some duds in there, aren't you? Or some that just don't make money or don't reach full commercialization. If you have others that, you know, do well, that kind of balances it out. So that's the whole investment case. So I guess scale is a good thing.
Yeah, right? It's a classic. I mean, US VC model. You know, you have a very broad portfolio of companies, yeah. And you know, out of the 200 companies you invest in, if one of them makes it big, turns into Amazon or Facebook, you are laughing.
Yeah.
Who cares about the other 199?
Yeah, and Touchstone's management did actually say, we saw, not only did their larger shareholders, which they share, all the group share, obviously the same large shareholders, like Woodford. He said not only did the large shareholders encourage them to kind of to enter into discussion with IP, but also they saw merit in the deal. So that's not a flat no. That's not saying that it's, you know, they did see merit in this deal. It was just they couldn't agree the terms. So who knows? There might be another deal, maybe not between them even, maybe, you know, Allied Minds. But I think consolidation in this sector does seem likely.
Good. Quite interesting. Reason to buy the shares? Or is it all in the price already?
Well,
if we can work out how
we
get to that
we've
price.
Actually, I think, yeah, we've actually got them. Last time I looked, a lot of them were trading at premiums to their NAV. Again, how do you value that?
Not especially attractive.
I think if I was a shareholder, I'd be a little bit worried about this, to be honest. I mean, this VC model, their core idea is to make lots of small investments. When you're going for mergers, it seems like they've spend a little bit too much time with investment bankers who think there's logic of the broader synergies of consolidating an industry, which, I mean, it's not about consolidation, it seems to me. It's about long-term investments in small growth companies rather than the benefits of adding another 100 companies to your stable.
But you're not just adding 100 companies, you're adding the entire, I mean, so these companies
the
have different
with
relationships with different
universities, yeah.
And the more universities you have in the pool, the more intellectual properties
come through,
the more you can direct what's happening in those universities, presumably to some degree.
Yeah, they have good links with, like, Imperial,
yeah.
For instance, like UCL.
This is Touchstone,
yeah. So if you've got a really good relationship with those universities, the idea is that you have... Yeah, you have broader connections, and also, I mean, diversity is key with these companies. So,
I don't know. I'm not sure I agree with you on this one, Alex. I am always sceptical of, you know, the influence of investment bankers in certain M&A, but I can see logic to this.
Yeah.
You know, as I say, it's the probabilities of finding the big one just improve,
yeah,
when you have a larger portfolio.
But I mean, it strikes me that a relationship with a university, I mean, the hurdles to building a relationship with a university, I mean, don't seem as...
But they're exclusive deals.
Are they exclusive deals?
Yeah, okay, yeah. So, and in fact, if I'm right, I think Touchstone was formerly Imperial Innovations.
Yeah.
Because of its relationship
because
with
of its,
Imperial.
Yeah, exactly.
And only Touchstone has that relationship with Imperial, which is one of the preeminent science-based universities in the UK.
Yeah, you get rights over their IP, yeah.
So I don't know, Alex. I think we're going to...
Well, that's an exclusive deal in itself is a bad thing, then. I'm going to change my opinion mid-rant.
I quite like this model. I quite like the fact that, you know, there is some kind of potential feedback in terms of financing into universities. There's a lot of concerns at the moment around the financing of university research post-Brexit. I quite like this model. I think it's interesting. Okay, we're running out of time. We've been talking a lot. Let's quickly turn to results because it's the last busy week of results before we get into July. Alex, let's start with you. You've gone off piste this week. Telford Homes.
Yes.
Goodness me, how did you end up there?
Well, I think Jonas Crosland is away.
Oh yeah, so, that would be it.
Yeah. Telford being the build-to-rent...
it's a house builder.
And house builder.
Becoming a
builder. Build-to-rent focused house builder. We've been fans of this for, it seems like, time immemorial, but they've been doing very, very well recently. The build-to-rent model, I mean, maybe it's just very, very briefly recapping what that is, that there's a lot of institutional money that wants to get into property, but they want it at, obviously, a better price, but they're willing to fund the construction of large schemes up front. That's good news for people like Telford Homes. Telford Homes is really the leader in the sector, it looks like, because it takes financing requirements off their balance sheet. Also means that they don't have huge amounts of working capital tied up in these schemes. So they're able to grow, it looks like, at a clip at the moment. And they, you know, they already have £230 million pounds worth of build to rent properties, and this is, you know, this new strategy is barely 2 years old. They think they're going to, you know, this is going to comprise at least half of their revenues within a couple of years.
I mean, it's a sweet spot in terms of the kind of political environment and the housing strategy of whoever wins the general election.
Yeah, well, I mean
it's not going to change.
Absolutely. I mean, the chief executive said to me that it's pretty agnostic about who wins the. Wins the election because, you know, London has a chronic shortage of housing. But, you know, I suppose if corporate tax rate does jump to 26%, that the entire, you know, the sector won't be completely happy. But you know, there's not a manifesto out there which has not put housing as one of the focuses. Of course, they do that every time, don't they?
Well, indeed. I have paid a lot of attention to the manifestos and I don't believe a word in them. 24% discount to the average price book value for the sector. I mean, these shares seem extraordinarily cheap for a company that has not only proved itself a very capable house builder, but has shifted its model to really embrace the changes that are taking place in this market.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a brilliantly run company.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's we're always looking for the faults when we look at companies or the, you know, the potential headwinds. It's hard to see with Telford where the, you know, the immediate problems might arise. I suppose costs and labour.
Let's touch wood before we say that.
Sure.
Kind of thing.
Costs and labour may be an issue. You know, in the next couple of years. I mean, at the moment they're saying that's not really a problem. But you know, they're not very highly geared. They're paying a good dividend. It may just be that that discount to the rest of the market. Maybe investors still processing, you know, this new model, the build to rent model, and you know, there might be a bit of disbelief that pension funds really are going to stay into this or pour into this long term. Who knows? I mean, they're doing very, very well at the moment.
I think there's no evidence to suggest that pension funds will get cold feet here. This is as we were talking about earlier. I mean, you know, pension funds need assets.
Well, they're trying to find yield. They're trying to find alternative assets. Yeah,
exactly. Whether it be cheese or whiskey or build to rent flats. Mm. I mean, it's they need this stuff. So yeah, I can't see where there would be problems here. But hey, listen, who knows what's going to happen in the next year with the economy and. Who knows where we're going politically? It's a very exciting time in that respect, if you find that kind of thing exciting. Emma, pick a result.
Yeah, so there's United Utilities results this week. We've got them on a buy tip. I think I tipped them maybe 2 years ago now. Obviously, they're right in the midst of the current regulatory period, AMP6, which is a five-year period. They're doing well. They've just committed another $100 million additional capital into their operational improvements. They're judged against this thing called outcome delivery incentives, which is a technical term. But basically, they say once they submit their business plan at the start of the regulatory period, we're going to deliver X, Y, and it could be, I don't know, reduce leakages by this amount or improve complaints handling by this amount.
And when it achieves these targets,
you get a financial reward.
They get a financial reward.
Yeah.
So they're allowed as a utility to make a certain amount of profit. And then if they achieve these extra targets, stretch targets, whatever you want to call them,
yeah,
they can make some more money.
Yeah, exactly. So they'll all set a certain amount of targets. So a really good way to judge the progress of something like a water company, because they are quite steady eddy, but that's why you buy them, is by looking at how they're doing against their outcome delivery incentives. And United Utilities are doing well, hence why they've just committed this extra $100 million capital.
And we still like this sector, generally.
Yeah, I mean, water companies is just pure income play, basically. They set their dividend policies at the start of every regulatory period, which is 5 years, and basically they just keep to that.
Okay, I mean, as you say, pure income plays, lovely, lovely income generating, regular as clockwork, but that's why Jeremy Corbyn would like to have them back for the country. Are we worried about this risk?
I mean, yeah, I mean, that is a risk, isn't it? If you are a shareholder in one of these companies, I mean, I don't know. Are you going to...
Who knows what would happen? Because I mean, we've actually tipped one of the other water companies in the...
Pennon
in the tip section this week. And again, I mean, it looks just as strong as United Utilities.
Stronger, I'd argue, because it's got the best dividend, the most generous dividend policy in the water sector. I think it's RPI plus 4% every year. So what's not to like?
No, what's not to like?
I suppose one of the defensive things is that, I mean, with United Utilities, just look at the debt profile there as well. You know, if this was going to be nationalised, that's quite a... If you're taking the debt into account of with the market cap and the enterprise value is going to be, you know, a big, big deal were they to be taken back over by government.
Yeah, nobody's really talked about that. I mean, people have, you know, for example, when these ideas of renationalising certain utilities were first mooted after the launch of Labour's manifesto, people talked about the value of National Grid's UK distribution business and the market cap of these water companies, but they haven't actually talked about the kind of financial structure of them. And as you say, they tend to have a very large amount of debt.
Yeah, that's
it's the way they work.
Yeah, because they've got such large assets. That's why they have such large debt.
So basically, you know, you are paying. You would have to pay the shareholders to buy back the shares. You would have to take on the debt onto the national accounts. Yeah, this all adds up quite quickly.
I suppose you know, the Labour would say, well, you refinance the debt at government borrowing rates, which would be a lot cheaper. But there's still the debt pile.
I don't know what their borrowing rates are, but I don't think they would be particularly high.
Right.
Companies like this.
Right.
I think these guys can borrow very, very cheaply already.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, there we go. Anyway, lots more results in the results section this week. Thank you, Emma, and thank you, Alex, for your insights today. Right, just to run you through what else we've got in the magazine, Alex has written the Sector Focus this week on mineral sands, which is a good read. A couple of features which we haven't talked about today because neither of the writers of those features are here. James Norrington has taken a look at volatility in the VIX and what it really means, because a lot has been said about it in what we suggest is quite a sensational manner. Philip is looking at some very detailed accounting techniques that we believe will help you assess companies better. Lots in the personal finance and funds section. Not one, but two portfolio clinics this week. They will be talking about their fund section on their podcast tomorrow. And all the usual news beyond what we've spoken about already. Lots of company results, as I've said, and the usual comments. There you go. That is it for me for a month. Never mind the volatility. Read into that what you will. £4.90 in all good news agents. Yeah, or get online and subscribe. And I will see you again in a few weeks.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
And leave you in the capable hands of my colleagues. Thank you very much.